I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Professor of Mind and Psychology at Harvard, Steven Pinker. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Steven Pinker.
Our guest this afternoon is cognitive scientist Steven Pinker. He's the John Stone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, and one of the world's foremost writers on language, mind, and human nature. Professor Pinker's research has won prizes from the National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Institution, the Cognitive Neuroscience Society, and the American Psychological Association. He's also received critical acclaim for his New York Times best-selling books, The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, and The Better Angels of Our Nature. He's been named Humanist of the Year, Foreign Policy's 100 Global Thinkers, and Time's 100 Most Influential People in the World Today. His latest book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century, he asks questions like, why is so much writing so bad? And how can we make it better? Do people write badly on purpose? And do the kids today even care about good writing? He's here today to answer these questions and more. Ladies and gentlemen, Steven Pinker.
Thank you very much. Why is so much writing so bad? And how can we make it better? Why do we have to endure so much legalese, as in the revocation by these regulations of a provision previously revoked subject to savings does not affect the continued operations? Why do we have to endure so much academies, as in it is the moment of non-construction, disclosing the absentation of actuality from the concept, in part through its invitation to emphasize in reading the helplessness of its fall into conceptuality? Why is it so hard to set the time on a digital alarm clock? Well, there are no shortage of theories, and probably the most popular one is captured in this cartoon, where the boss says to the tech writer, good start, needs more gibberish. In other words, bad writing is a deliberate choice. Bureaucrats insist on gibberish to evade responsibility. It's the revenge of the nerds. The pasty-faced, plaid-clad tech writers get their revenge on the girls who turned them down for dates in high school and the jocks who kicked sand in their faces. Pseudo-intellectuals try to bamboozle their readers with highfalutin gobbledygook, trying to conceal the fact that they have nothing to say. Well, I don't doubt that the bamboozlement theory is true of some writers some of the time, but I don't think it is a good general explanation, because good people can write bad prose. I know plenty of scientists and scholars who do groundbreaking research on important topics. They have nothing to hide and no need to impress. Still, their writing stinks. The second most popular theory is that it's digital media that are ruining the language. Google is making us stupid. The digital age stupefies young Americans and jeopardizes our future. Well, Twitter forces us to write in 140 characters. An implication of the dumbest generation theory is that things were much better before the advent of digital media. You all remember, those of you old enough to remember what life was like before there was Twitter and Facebook and instant messaging, say back in the 1980s, when teenagers spoke in articulate paragraphs and bureaucrats wrote in plain English and every academic article was a masterpiece in the art of the essay. Or was it the 70s? Maybe it was the 1960s, but back then, There were people writing things like, recent graduates, including those with university degrees, seem to have no mastery of the language at all. Okay, well, maybe you have to go even farther back before the invention of television and radio, like 1917, when someone said, from every college in the country goes up the cry, our freshmen can't spell, can't punctuate. Every high school is in disrepair because its pupils are so ignorant of the merest rudiments. Okay, well, maybe the golden age of writing was during the European Enlightenment. But in 1785, we find a writer complaining, our language is degenerating very fast. I begin to fear that it will be impossible to check it. And then there are the ancient grammar police. Oh, for crying out loud, you never end a sentence with a little birdie. I think a better theory comes from an observation by Charles Darwin that man has an instinctive tendency to speak, as we see in the babble of our young children, whereas no child has an instinctive tendency to bake, brew, or write. That is, whereas speech is instinctive, writing is and always has been hard. The readers are unknown, they're invisible, they're inscrutable, they exist only in the writer's imagination. They can't react, break in, ask for clarification if the writing is unclear. And so writing, above all, is an act of pretense, and writing is an act of craftsmanship. Well, what can we do to improve the craft of writing? For many decades, there was a single answer to this question. That is, you hand students this. The iconic Elements of Style by Cornell English professor William Strunk Jr. and his former student E.B. White, who went on to fame as the New Yorker essayist and author of Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little. And there is indeed a lot of good sense in the Elements of Style. It is well worth reading today. They have little bits of good advice like use definite, specific, concrete language, write with nouns and verbs, put the emphatic words at the end, and my favorite, their prime directive, omit needless words, which is an excellent example of itself. There are no needless words in that bit of advice. On the other hand, there are a number of reasons why the Elements of Style cannot be the basis, at least the only basis, of writing advice in the 21st century. You'll notice that the younger, the junior member of this pair was born before the turn of the century, that is, before the turn of the 20th century. And much of the advice is genuinely obsolete. Like, avoid the verb to finalize. It's a pompous, ambiguous verb. Or to contact is vague and self-important. Do not contact people. Get in touch with them, look them up, phone them, find them, or meet them. Well, if you don't care whether someone phones or finds or meets or, for that matter, emails or texts, then to contact is an extremely useful verb, which is why it has become an unexceptionable part of the English language. And then some of the advice is just baffling. The word people is not to be used with words of number in place of persons. That is, you may not say six people. Why not? Well, if of six people, five went away, how many people would be left? Answer, one people. Did you follow that? If this were good advice, one would not be able to say, I have three children, or 32 teeth, or any other irregular plural. Or how about this? Note that the word clever means one thing when applied to people, another when applied to horses. A clever horse is a good-natured one, not an ingenious one. The problem with traditional style advice is that it consists of an arbitrary list of do's and don'ts based on the tastes and peeves of the authors. There's no principled understanding of how language works, and as a result, users have no way of understanding and assimilating the advice, and much of the advice is just wrong. I think we can do better today. We can base writing advice on the science and scholarship of language, on modern grammatical theory, which provides better ways of understanding syntax than the old lessons ported over from Latin, on evidence-based dictionaries and grammars, on research from cognitive science on what makes sentences easy or hard to read, and historical and critical studies of usage. And it's these bodies of knowledge that I've tried to bring together in the Sense of Style. It all begins with a model of effective prose. As I've mentioned, writing is an unnatural act. And good style requires, above all, some coherent mental model of the communication scenario. What is the writer's relationship to the reader, and what is he trying to accomplish? And my favorite model for effective communication comes from a book by Francis Noël Thomas and Mark Turner called Clear and Simple as the Truth, and they call it classic style. The model behind classic style is that prose is a window onto the world. The writer has seen something in the world. He positions the reader so that she can see it with her own eyes. The writer and reader are equals. The writer's goal is to help the reader see objective reality, and the style is conversation. Well, what are non-classic styles? That all sounds pretty obvious and hard to take exception with. Well, they distinguish a number of other approaches to writing, contemplative style, oracular style, practical style. And they note that the problem with academics is that they write in what they call postmodern or self-conscious style, in which the writer's chief, if unstated, concern is to escape being convicted of philosophical naivete about his own enterprise. As they explain, when we open a cookbook, we completely put aside, and expect the author to put aside, the kind of question that leads to the heart of certain philosophical traditions. Is it possible to talk about cooking? Do eggs really exist? Is food something about which knowledge is possible? Can anyone ever tell us anything true about cooking? Classic style similarly puts aside as inappropriate philosophical questions about its enterprise. If it took those questions up, it could never get around to treating its subject, and its purpose is exclusively to treat its subject. Well, the idea behind classic prose is that you show the reader something in the world, and so I would be hypocritical if I did not show you an example of classic prose. But I've picked a few sentences from an article by the physicist Brian Greene that appeared in Newsweek magazine on the theory of inflationary cosmology and one of its implications, the multiverse. Greene writes, "If space is now expanding, then at ever earlier times, the universe must have been ever smaller. At some moment in the distant past, everything we now see, the ingredients responsible for every planet, every star, every galaxy, even space itself, must have been compressed to an infinitesimal speck that then swelled outward, evolving into the universe as we know it. The Big Bang Theory was born. Yet scientists were aware that the Big Bang Theory suffered from a significant shortcoming. Of all things, it leaves out the bang. Einstein's equations do a wonderful job of explaining how the universe evolved from a split second after the bang, but the equations break down, similar to the error message returned by a calculator when you try to divide 1 by 0 when applied to the extreme environment of the universe's earliest moment. The Big Bang thus provides no insight into what might have powered the bang itself." Now, there's a fair amount of pretty sophisticated physics packed into those few sentences. But Greene does not dwell over how complex it is, but he tells the story in a way that readers can see the subject matter with their own eyes. If you can imagine space expanding outward, then you can run the mental movie backwards and imagine earlier and earlier times culminating with the infinitesimal speck, which means that if you run the movie forward again, you see the Big Bang in your mind's eye. And the abstruse mathematical concept of equations breaking down, he makes apparent even to a non-mathematical reader by saying, well, go ahead and try it. Divide 1 by 0 on your calculator, and indeed, it doesn't give you an answer. It will give you an error message. Or you could even contemplate what it could possibly mean to divide 1 into 0 parts, or into parts each of which contain 0, to appreciate that there are conceptual problems with division by 0, and that is exactly what equations breaking down means. Many examples of writing advice are implications of this single model behind classic prose. For example, in classic prose, the focus is on the thing being shown, not on the activity of studying it. And here is an example of a bit of non-classic prose of the kind that I deal with constantly in reading review articles, student term papers in my own field. In recent years, an increasing number of researchers have turned their attention to the problem of child language acquisition. In this article, recent theories of this process will be reviewed. Well, no offense, but very few people are fascinated by how professors spend their time. A more classic introduction to the same article could have been, "All children acquire the ability to speak and understand a language without explicit lessons. How do they accomplish this feat?" A corollary is that classic prose minimizes the kind of apologizing that is common in academic language. For example, the problem of language acquisition is extremely complex. It is difficult to give precise definitions of the concept of language and the concept of acquisition and the concept of children. There is much uncertainty about the interpretation of experimental data and a great deal of controversy surrounding the theories. More research needs to be done. Now, this is the kind of text that simply can be deleted as a block with no loss of content, because classic prose gives the reader credit for knowing that many concepts are hard to define and many controversies are hard to resolve. The reader is there to see what the writer is going to do about it. Another corollary is to minimize the reflexive hedging that fuzzes up academic prose, where many writers feel the need to drizzle their sentences with little bits of fuzz, like somewhat, fairly, nearly, seemingly, in part, relatively, comparatively, predominantly, to some extent, presumably, just to give the impression that they aren't willing to stand behind what they're saying. An example comes from a letter of recommendation that I recently received for a talented young woman whose advisor said, she is a quick study, using shutter quotes, and has been able to educate herself in virtually any area that interests her. Well, when we read this, are we supposed to interpret it as meaning that she's a quick study, or rather that she is a quick study? That is, someone who's alleged or rumored to be a quick study, but perhaps isn't. And if she's been able to educate herself in virtually any area that interests her, are there some areas that interest her where she tried and failed? The unthinking use of hedges was brought home to me when I ran into a colleague at a recent conference and I asked her how she was doing. She pulled out a picture of her 4-year-old daughter and she said, "We virtually adore her." Ah. Why the compulsive, even robotic hedging? Well, it's to follow the imperative that bureaucrats know by the acronym CYA, cover your anatomy. And there is an alternative, namely, so sue me. That is, in clear prose, it is often better to be clear and possibly wrong than fuzzy and not even wrong. Also, a good writer counts on the cooperative nature of ordinary conversation. You could not have a conversation unless you extended some charity to your conversational partner and made reasonable inferences about what they mean when they use a sentence. So if someone says, in the past decade, Americans have been getting fatter, you don't interpret that as meaning that every last one of the 340 million citizens of the United States is getting fatter. In context, you interpret it as on average or in general or as a trend. Classic prose also keeps up the illusion that the reader is seeing a world rather than listening to verbiage. And as a result, it follows the venerable advice to avoid cliches like the plague. And we're all familiar with the writer who says things like, "We needed to get the ball rolling in our search for the Holy Grail, but found that it was neither a magic bullet nor a slam dunk. So we rolled with the punches and let the chips fall where they may while seeing the glass is half full." It's a no-brainer. The problem with the writer who just cranks out cliches is that he either forces his reader to turn off her visual brain and just process the language as blah, 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 blah. Or if she does endeavor to keep in mind what the prose is referring to, she will be struck by ludicrous images, particularly when the writer will do, as you will inevitably do if you use cliches, mixes metaphors. Another letter of recommendation said that Jeff is a Renaissance man, drilling down to the core issues and pushing the envelope. Not really clear how you can do both at the same time. From a news article, "No one has yet invented a condom that will knock people's socks off." Oh. Bad cliche. And such a writer will also be eligible for membership in AWFUL, Americans Who Figuratively Use Literally. Now, there is nothing wrong with saying she literally blushed, but it is far worse to say she literally exploded. And it's very, very bad to say she literally emasculated him.
You're listening to Harvard professor Steven Pinker, whose latest book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Classic prose is about the world. It's not about the conceptual tools with which we try to understand the world, and so it avoids the use of meta-concepts, that is, concepts about concepts that are all too familiar in stuffy, turgid prose. Words like approach, assumption, concept, condition, context, framework, issue level, model, perspective, process, role, strategy, tendency, and variable, which some writers just can't avoid in referring to anything. From the New York Times, an article by a legal scholar, I have serious doubts that trying to amend the Constitution would work on an actual level. On the aspirational level, however, a constitutional amendment strategy may be more valuable. Translation, I doubt that trying to amend the Constitution would actually succeed, but it may be valuable to aspire to it. You really don't need the levels. Or it's important to approach this subject from a variety of strategies, including mental health assistance, but also from a law enforcement perspective. That is, we should consult a psychiatrist about this man, but we may also have to inform the police. Classic prose narrates ongoing events. We see agents performing actions that affect objects. Non-classic prose tends to thingify events and then refer to the thing. Using a dangerous tool of English grammar called nominalization, making a verb into a noun. So instead of competing, you engage in competition. Instead of organizing something, you bring about the organization of that thing. Helen Sword, an English scholar, calls them zombie nouns because they kind of lumber across the scene with no conscious agent actually directing their motion. And they can turn prose into a Night of the Living Dead. From the methods section of a psychology paper, participants read assertions whose veracity was either affirmed or denied by subsequent presentation of an assessment word. That is, the participants saw sentences, each followed by the word true or false. Subjects were tested under conditions of good to excellent acoustic isolation, to wit, we tested the students in a quiet room. But it's not just academics who use zombie language. It's also politicians. A couple of years ago, Governor Rick Perry of Texas, when asked about a hurricane that threatened the Republican National Convention, said, right now there is not any anticipation that there will be a cancellation. That is, right now we don't anticipate that we will have to cancel it. And on the other side of the political spectrum, we have former Secretary of State John Kerry, Secretary of State, who said, the president is desirous of trying to see how we can make our best efforts in order to find a way to facilitate. Translation, the president wants to help. Also, corporate consultants. A man told a reporter when he was asked what he did for a living, he said, I'm a digital and social media strategist. I deliver programs, products, and strategies to our corporate clients across the spectrum of communication functions. And when the reporter pressed him as to what that actually means, he finally relented and he said, I teach big companies how to use Facebook. And product engineers. Portable generators used to carry a warning that read as follows. Mild exposure to CO can result in accumulated damage over time. Extreme exposure to CO may rapidly be fatal without producing significant warning symptoms. Yeah, whatever. And as a result, every year, hundreds of Americans asphyxiated themselves and their families by running portable generators indoors. Well, more recently, this has been replaced by the following warning. Using a generator indoors can kill you in minutes. So classic style can literally be a matter of life and death. Literally. Well, how can an understanding of the design of language lead to better writing advice? Another major contributor to zombie prose is the passive voice, the difference between the dog bit the man, which is in the active voice, and the man was bitten by the dog in the passive voice. The passive voice is overused by academics. On the basis of the analysis which was made of the data which were collected, it is suggested that the null hypothesis can be rejected. And lawyers, if the outstanding balance is prepaid in full, the unearned finance charge will be refunded. Three passive verbs in a row. And notoriously, political officials. Some of you may recognize this woman. She, until recently, was director of the Secret Service and was called upon in Congress to explain how it was that a man with a knife managed to vault over the White House fence, walk unimpeded across the White House lawn, let himself into the White House, and approach the president's bedroom before someone finally noticed him. And she said, "Mistakes were made." That is the evasive passive. Well, not surprisingly, all the classic style manuals warn against use of the passive voice. Strunk and White, for example, advise use the active voice. The active voice is usually more direct and vigorous than the passive. Many a tame sentence can be made lively and emphatic by substituting a transitive in the active voice for some such perfunctory expression as "there is" or "could be heard." Well, the little bits of tittering from the audience come from people who recognize that, yes, Strunk and White used the passive to warn readers not to use the passive. Well, the other absolutely standard, iconic bit of writing advice that is handed out to every college freshman is George Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language, which he too wrote, a mixture of vagueness and sheer incompetence is the most marked characteristic of modern English prose, he said, writing in the 1940s. I list below various of the tricks by means of which the work of prose construction is habitually dodged. The passive voice is wherever possible used in preference to the active, a passage that has not just one but two passive sentences in deploring how terrible the passive voice is. So what's going on? Well, the passive could not have survived in the English language for 1,500 years if it did not serve some purpose. Why can't we do without it? It comes down to the design of language. You can think of language as an app for converting a web of knowledge into a string of words. Now, the knowledge that sits in all of our heads can be modeled as a semantic network, a kind of mind-wide web, consisting of a bunch of concepts interconnected by logical and conceptual relationships. So this might be how a cognitive psychologist would model a fragment of a person's knowledge about the tragic story of Oedipus Rex as brought to life by Sophocles in his immortal play. Well, what happens now when you've got to take this tangle of ideas connected to each other in every which way, a knowledge base that allows you to daydream from one concept to another in pretty much any order you want. And now it's time to tell someone else about what you know. Well, you've got to use a sentence. What is a sentence but a linear string of words? In Sophocles' play, Oedipus married his mother and killed his father, one word after another. What this means is that there's an inherent problem in the design of language. The order of words in a sentence has to do two things at once. On the one hand, it serves as our code for meaning, for who did what to whom. Did Oedipus kill Laius or did Laius kill Oedipus? We know because of the order of the words. On the other hand, it necessarily presents some bits of information before others and thereby affects the way the information is absorbed. Early material in the sentence looks back to what's already been discussed so far, the topic of the conversation. It's what the reader is looking at. Later material in the sentence is the focal point. It's the new information that the reader now notices. Any prose that violates these principles will feel choppy or disjointed or incoherent. And that's where the passive voice comes in. It's a workaround for this flaw of language. It allows writers to convey the same semantic information, namely who did what to whom, while varying the surface order. In particular, it allows writers to start with begin the sentence with the done to rather than the doer. And that is why avoid the passive is, well, not just bad advice, it's impossible advice, quite literally, because neither Orwell nor Strunk and White was even able to say it without using the passive voice. And the reason is the passive is the better construction when the done to is currently the target of the reader's mental gaze. And again, I'm going to illustrate with a concrete example. This comes from the Wikipedia entry for Oedipus Rex, in which the entry gives the summary of the plot. And this paragraph comes from its description of the climactic moment of Oedipus Rex, in which the audience is let into the terrible backstory behind the event so far. Spoiler alert. A messenger arrives from Corinth. It emerges that he was formerly a shepherd on Mount Kithaeron, and during that time he was given a baby. The baby, he says, was given to him by another shepherd from the Laius household, who had been told to get rid of the child. Now notice that this passage has three passives in a row, for good reason. The narration begins with a messenger arriving. So all eyes are on the messenger, and the next sentence must begin with him. He was given a baby. Passive voice allows you to do that. Well, now all eyes are on the baby, and so the next sentence has to begin with the baby. The baby was given to the messenger by another shepherd. Well, now we're looking at that other shepherd, and so the next sentence should begin with him. The other shepherd had been told to get rid of the child. You have a perfectly coherent progression where the sentence begins with the entity that the reader is currently, so to speak, looking at. Well, now let's imagine that you followed the advice of the style books and you converted the passive sentences to the active voice. Here's the way it would read. A messenger arrives from Corinth. It emerges that he was formerly a shepherd on Mount Kithaeron, and during that time someone gave him a baby. Another shepherd from the Laius household, he says, whom someone had told to get rid of a child, gave the baby to him. Well, this is not an improvement, because our attention is being kind of jerked all over the stage. Characters appear without advance warning, and so this is actually an inferior version of the same telling of events. More generally, English syntax provides writers with constructions that vary order in the string while preserving meaning. Oedipus killed Laius, Laius was killed by Oedipus, it was Laius whom Oedipus killed, it was Oedipus who killed Laius, and so on. And the challenge for the writer is to choose the construction that introduces ideas to the reader in the order in which she can best absorb them. Well, this brings us back to the original puzzle. Why, then, is the passive so common in bad writing, as it is? The reason is that good writers narrate a story advanced by protagonists who make things happen. Bad writers work backwards from their own knowledge, writing down ideas in the order in which they occur to them. Now, the writer knows how the story turned out, so it's natural to begin with that. They begin with the outcome and event, then they throw in the cause as an afterthought, and the passive just makes that all too easy. This leads to my third question. Why are writers so prone to doing that? Why is it so hard for writers to use the resources of language to convey ideas effectively? My favorite explanation is a psychological phenomenon called the curse of knowledge. The fact that when you know something, it's hard to imagine what it's like for someone else not to know it. Also called mind blindness, egocentrism, or hindsight bias. And a simple way to illustrate it is from a well-known experiment familiar to every introductory psychology student that I'll call the M&M study. 3-year-old comes into a room, hand him a box of candy, opens the box, and instead of candies inside, he's surprised to find that it contains ribbons. And so the experimenter puts the ribbons back into the box, closes it back up, and says, well, now another little boy is going to come to the lab, Jason. What does he think is in the box? And the first boy says, ribbons. That is, now that he knows that it contains ribbons, he assumes that everyone else must know it, even though, of course, they had no way of knowing it. In fact, if you ask the boy, what did you think was in the box when you first, before you opened it, and he would say, ribbons. He can no longer recover the innocent state before acquiring some bit of knowledge. Now, of course, kids outgrow this error, sort of. Because even adults are, in many studies, have been shown to over-attribute their own vocabulary to others. If someone knows a word, they assume that everyone else knows it. If they know a fact, they assume that everyone else knows it. The more familiar you are with a gadget, that is, the longer you've spent with a cell phone, the less time you think it will take someone else to learn how to use it. Because it's so easy to you, and so you assume that it's easy to everyone else. I think the curse of knowledge is the chief contributor to opaque writing. It simply doesn't occur to the writer that readers haven't learned their jargon, don't know the intermediate steps that seem too obvious to mention, can't visualize a scene that's currently in the writer's mind's eye, and so the writer just doesn't bother to explain the jargon or spell out the logic or supply the concrete details, even when writing for professional peers. You often hear the excuse from professionals, well, it doesn't matter if I use jargon because I'm writing for people in the same field. They'll know what I mean, but they don't all too often. And again, I'll give you an example. This comes from an article on consciousness in the journal Trends in Cognitive Science, which is explicitly designed so people can keep up with their field by reading the work of their peers. It reads, "The slow and integrative nature of conscious perception is confirmed behaviorally by observations such as the rabbit illusion and its variants, where the way in which a stimulus is ultimately perceived is influenced by post-stimulus events arising several hundreds of milliseconds after the original stimulus." Well, this is written for the likes of me, and I had no idea what they're talking about. They assume that everyone knows what the rabbit illusion is, but I've been a cognitive psychologist for almost 40 years, and I'd never heard of it. Also, what's a stimulus? What does the way in which a stimulus is perceived actually mean? So I went to my books and I found there is an obscure demonstration in psychology called the cutaneous rabbit illusion. And it works as follows. A person closes his eyes, holds out his arm, and then the experimenter taps him 3 times on the wrist, 3 times on the elbow, 3 times on the shoulder, and the person experiences a set of continuous taps running up the length of his arm like a hopping rabbit. That's why it's called the rabbit illusion. Significance is that where you perceive the early taps depends on where you felt the later taps, and so your consciousness doesn't track stimulation in real time, but it's kind of edited after the fact to make your experience more coherent. Well, that's interesting, but why didn't they just say that? It is no more scientific to talk about a stimulus than a tap on the arm. In fact, it's less scientific because if you know that it's a tap on the arm, then you can evaluate the argument and decide for yourself whether the rabbit illusion really does show that consciousness is slow and integrative, or perhaps has some other explanation. So it's actually a poor excuse that jargon is necessary to embody scientific rigor and communicate with scientific peers. In fact, it often does the exact opposite. My favorite reminder of the perils of needless abbreviation come from an old joke. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. A man walks into the dining room of a Catskills resort, and he sees a bunch of retired Borscht Belt comedians sitting around a table, and he joins them. He hears one of them say, 112, and everyone bursts out into uproarious laughter. The next one says, 47, again, huge peals of guffaws and laughs. He can't figure out what's going on. So he asks the guy next to him. He says, what's happening here? The guy says, well, you know, these old timers have been around each other so long that they all know the same jokes. And so to save time, they've given each joke a number and they can just recite the number. The guy says, oh, that's ingenious. Why don't I try it? So he says, 34. Stony silence. 96. Everyone turns around and stares at him and no one laughs. So he kind of sinks back down into his seat and he asks the guy next to him, what happened? What did I do wrong? The guy said, oh, it's all in how you tell it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Harvard professor Steven Pinker, whose latest book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, how do we exercise the curse of knowledge? The traditional advice is to keep in mind the reader over your shoulder. That is to empathize with your reader, see the world from his point of view, walk a mile in his moccasins, feel his pain, and so on. And that's good as far as it goes, and I highly recommend it. So for what it's worth, I'm talking to all of you. Your readers know less than you think they do, and unless you try very hard to imagine what you know that they don't know, you're guaranteed to confuse them. But it doesn't go very far, because the curse of knowledge prevents us from realizing how we're vulnerable to the curse of knowledge. None of us has mental telepathy. We are not very good at guessing other people's knowledge, even when we try very hard. Better solutions are to actually find a reader and show a draft to them. You'll often be shocked to discover that what's obvious to you is not obvious to anyone else. You can show a draft to yourself after some time has elapsed and the prose is no longer familiar to you. If you're like me, you'll find yourself saying, what did I mean by that? Or how does this follow? Or all too often, who wrote this crap? At which point, one should rewrite, ideally several times, with a single goal: just improve the quality of the prose, just make sure it's understandable to the reader. Very few people are smart enough to get ideas down on the page and have those ideas flow in a way that a reader can comprehend them. Most of us mortals have to separate it out and devote explicit effort and attention simply to making the prose comprehensible to readers. Finally, how should we think about correct usage, which is the issue of writing that by far attracts the most attention? Now, some usages are clearly wrong. When Cookie Monster said, "Me want cookie," it's so obvious that he made an error that this serves as a form of humor even for four-year-old children. If he wasn't making an error, this would not be funny. ICANN has cheeseburger. Those of you familiar with lolcats know that this is a snide remark about the grammatical competence of cats. And it would not have any humor, such as it is, unless everyone recognized that this sentence contains a grammatical error. Is our children learning? Even former President George W. Bush acknowledged that this was a grammatical error in a self-deprecating speech in which he went over all of the grammatical errors he had made in previous press conferences and speeches to make fun of himself. There are other issues of usage that are not quite as obvious, and just to be bipartisan, I'll give you an example from a Democratic president. When he was running for president in 1992, one of his campaign slogans was, "Give Al Gore and I a chance to bring America back," which a number of purists would claim contains a grammatical error, sometimes called the "between you and I" error. Namely, it should be "between you and me, give Al Gore and me a chance to bring America back." Another Democratic president recently said, "No American should ever live under a cloud of suspicion just because of what they look like." The singular "they" construction, allegedly an error because the plural pronoun "they" is being forced into agreement with the singular antecedent "no American." To boldly go where no man has gone before, the infamous split infinitive. "Well, you think you lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say." Anyone recognize the error? Preposition at the end of a sentence. Then the suave, urbane, articulate 1970s talk show host Dick Cavett recently wrote an article in the New York Times describing his college reunion, which he said, "Checking into the hotel, it was nice to see a few of my old classmates in the lobby." Anyone go to school before the 1960s and spot the supposed grammatical error in that one? Dangling modifier, otherwise known as a dangling participle. Well, contested issues such as these have given rise to what journalists call the language war between the prescriptivists and the descriptivists. According to this way of understanding usage, prescriptivists prescribe how people ought to speak. They are also known as the purists, sticklers, pedants, peevers, snobs, snoots, nitpickers, traditionalists, language police, usage nannies, grammar Nazis, and the gotcha gang, according to whom rules of usage are objectively correct. To obey them is to uphold standards of excellence. To flout them is to dumb down literate culture, degrade the language, and hasten the decline of civilization. On the other side, we have the descriptivists who describe how people do speak, who believe rules of usage are just the secret handshake of the ruling class. The people should be liberated to write however they please. Well, I think that this so-called language war, however beloved of journalists, is a pseudo-controversy. If it were true, you'd have prescriptivists insisting that the lyrics to the Beatles' She Love You should be, it's you of whom she's thinking. And the descriptivists would say there is nothing wrong with I can has cheeseburger. Now, this can't be right. There's got to be a more sophisticated way of thinking about usage. Well, what are rules of usage? Where do they even come from? They're certainly not logical truths that you could prove, like a proposition in mathematics or logic. And contrary to what many people seem to believe, they're not officially regulated by dictionaries. That is, the dictionary editors don't sit around a table and decide, well, this we're going to decree that this is the correct meaning of a word and that's the incorrect meaning. I can speak with some authority here because I am the chair of the usage panel at the American Heritage Dictionary. And when I joined them, the first question I asked the executive editor is, how do you guys decide what goes into the dictionary? And his answer was, we pay attention to the way people use words. That is, when it comes to what's correct in English, there's no one in charge. The lunatics are running the asylum. How do we make sense, then, of rules of usage? They are tacit evolving conventions. A convention is a way of doing something that has no inherent advantages other than the fact that everyone else is doing it the same way. Paper currency is a standard example. There is nothing particularly valuable about a green piece of paper with the president's face on it other than the fact that everyone else treats it as valuable. Driving on the right as opposed to the left is another example. There's nothing inherently wrong with driving on the left, but there's a joke that explains why it's good to drive on the same side as everyone else. A man is driving to work, and he gets a cell phone call from his wife. And she says to him, be very careful, honey. I've been listening to the radio, and they say that there's a maniac driving on the wrong lane of the freeway. And he says, one maniac? There are hundreds of them. The conventions of grammar are tacit. They emerge as a rough consensus within a community of careful writers without any explicit deliberation, agreement, or legislation. And they're evolving. The consensus may change over time, as it did with the verbs to finalize and to contact. So should writers follow the rules? The answer is it depends. Some rules just extend the logic of everyday grammar to more complicated cases. Why does everyone, including George W. Bush, agree that is our children learning is an error? Well, if you convert it back to the declarative sentence, our children is learning, that just jumps off the page as an error. And if that's wrong, the corresponding question must also be wrong. It should be, are our children learning? Likewise, a somewhat more subtle example, the impact of the cuts have not been felt yet. Now, it takes a little while to realize that that contains a grammatical error. It should be the impact of the cuts has not yet been felt yet, because the subject of the sentence is impact, and therefore that's the verb have should agree with that. The writer was distracted by the fact that the plural noun cuts was just sitting next door, and he made the verb agree with the noun next door instead of the subject of the sentence. How do we know? Well, let's just get rid of those intervening words. If you say the impact have not been felt yet, well, again, that just pops out as an obvious error, and by extension, the impact of the cuts have not been felt also must be an error. Also, there are some rules that make important semantic distinctions. The word fulsome, in the eyes of a literate reader, does not mean the same thing as the word full. If you thank someone for the fulsome praise they gave you, you are not complimenting either that person or yourself, because fulsome is not just a fancy schmancy way of saying full. It means insincerely flattering, excessive, oleaginous. It's not just a hoity-toity way of saying complete or extravagant. Similarly, you are well advised not to call something that you admire simplistic. It does not mean the same thing as simple. Simplistic means naive or childlike or overly simple. And if you think that something is meritorious, I recommend that you not call it meretricious in an attempt to sound sophisticated, because if you look it up, you'll see meretricious means something very, very different. In general, it's a good idea not to try to gussy up your language by using what you think is a fancy synonym for a common word. English rarely tolerates two words with the same stem or root, and different suffixes, like full and fulsome. They virtually always mean different things, and a writer is well advised to look them up and know what they mean. If not, you might elicit the reaction that Vizzini got in The Princess Bride when he kept referring to things that just happened as inconceivable. And Inigo Montoya replied, "You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means." On the other hand, not every pet peeve, bit of grammatical folklore, or dimly remembered lesson from Miss Thistlebottom's English class is a legitimate rule of usage. And many of the supposed rules out there turn out to violate grammatical logic, to be routinely flouted by the best writers, and have always been flouted by the best writers. A prime example being singular they. Recently, a purist wrote an angry article about how radical feminists have polluted the language by forcing us all to use this monstrous construction of singular they, everyone returned to their seats, so that they did not have to commit themselves to his or her, and that it would be better if we all went back to the crystalline prose of Jane Austen before radical feminism and political correctness. Oops. In an article called Everyone Loves Their Jane Austen, an English scholar counted and found that Jane Austen used singular they 87 times in her prose, such as everybody began to have their vexation. What about a sentence final preposition? Well, if you think that you can improve William Shakespeare's prose, then you can tinker with we are such stuff as dreams are made on. And the same is true of split infinitives, dangling participles between you and I. Contrary to popular belief, there is nothing wrong with those constructions. In fact, it's not just that you waste time and effort by obeying bogus rules, but it can actually make prose worse. Here's a sentence in a press release from my employer, Harvard University. David Rockefeller has pledged $100 million to increase dramatically learning opportunities for Harvard undergraduates. Now, I don't know what language that is, but it isn't English. What happened was the writer twisted himself into a pretzel to avoid a split infinitive to dramatically increase, and as a result, he ended up with word salad. In fact, obeying rules can even lead to a crisis of governance, literally. In 2009, Chief Justice John Roberts, who is a notorious stickler for grammar, he made his clerks miserable by sending back their briefs with all of the grammatical errors outlined, was in charge of administering the oath of office to Barack Obama, and the Constitution mandated that he have Obama recite these words. "I, Barack Obama, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States." Well, that contains a split verb, and Roberts, abandoning his strict constructionism, unilaterally amended the Constitution and had Obama recite the words, "I, Barack Obama, do solemnly swear that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully," which not only is not a stylistic improvement over the language of the framers, but it called into question the legitimacy of the transition of power. And so they had to repeat the oath in a private ceremony later that afternoon. If you think the birthers are a nuisance now, just imagine if Obama had never been sworn into office with the correct wording. Well, what's a writer to do? I've said that some rules are worth following, others are not. It seems like an intolerable burden on the writer. Well, the answer is unbelievably simple. Look them up. If you look up split infinitive in Merriam-Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, here's what you will find. It's all right to split an infinitive in the interest of clarity. Since clarity is the usual reason for splitting, this advice means merely that you can split them whenever you need to. And you'll get the same advice from the American Heritage Dictionary, the Encarta Dictionary, the Random House Dictionary. They all agree there's nothing wrong with splitting an infinitive. Modern dictionaries and style manuals, because they're based on actual scholarship on English as it has been used by good writers, do not ratify pet peeves, grammatical folklore, or bogus rules. Because they're based on evidence, if there are unclear cases where writers disagree, they would be explicitly discussed in usage notes so that writers can anticipate expectations and make their choices accordingly. They are not a backup for smarty pants one-upmanship. Also, correct usage should be kept in perspective, though I do think that writers should pay attention to the rules of correct usage. They're the least important part of good writing. They pale in significance compared to maintaining classic style, overcoming the curse of knowledge, to say nothing of factual diligence and coherent ideas and arguments. And even the most irksome errors are not signs of the decline of language, to say nothing of civilization. So to sum up, modern linguistics and cognitive science provide better ways of enhancing our prose. A model of prose communication, namely classic style, in which language is a window onto the world. An understanding of the way language works, namely a way of converting a web of thoughts into a string of words. A diagnosis of why good prose is so hard to write, namely the curse of knowledge, and a way to make sense of rules of correct usage, namely as tacit evolving conventions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody for coming, and thank you to Steven Pinker. Thank you very much.
Thanks, all of you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Harvard professor Steven Pinker, whose latest book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.